got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine. All the worries gonna leave my troubled mind. I've got a broken thing.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm the co-host, Kevin Fulta, professor of molecular biology and someone who really worries about you when it comes to science and helping you understand current issues.
And that's why we all appreciate Kevin so very much. We got four major stories to discuss, and no surprise, we're talking a lot about coronavirus today. First up, COVID-19 isn't just a bad case of the flu, contrary to what you may have heard on social media. There is a coronavirus vaccine in the works, but FDA regulations could slow its release significantly. In some upbeat news, though, a second person has possibly been cured of HIV after an experimental stem cell transplant. And finally, there's a new Pew survey looking at how Americans feel about GMOs. The results suggest that people are ill-informed and still fearful of biotechnology, but they also see some benefits of it. So we're going to get into those confusing results in a minute. But Kevin, let's start with why this isn't, in COVID-19, I mean, isn't just a bad case of the flu. And this is a story by geneticist Ricky Lewis over at Genetic Literacy Project.
No, very good story. I love this one. And how the F word, flu, led to confusion about what the coronavirus is. And this is really true, because if you talk to people in the general population, I mean, like not prison, I mean, you know, out and out in public, it says, people will say that, oh, okay, I had the flu, or I had the 24-hour flu or a stomach flu, and flu just kind of is equated with I wasn't feeling well. But influenza is a real thing, and physicians know exactly what that is. So here we are with this thing, SARS-CoV-2, which is the name of the virus. And people are excited to paint that, just the disorder of the COVID-19, with the same brush as influenza. And this article does a very nice job of showing how they're the same and how they're different.
So let's go into some of the similarities first off. So they're both RNA viruses. So to the average person, what does that mean? What does it mean to be something that's RNA-based versus DNA-based?
Well, DNA is the ultimate blueprint in higher organisms. So things like, you know, humans or plants or fungi or bacteria, DNA is the master blueprint that stays tucked away safely in, well, in storage, in eukaryotes, animals and plants, fungi, in the nucleus, and bacteria just kind of floats around there as a big piece of DNA. But DNA is very stable, and RNA is this temporary copy of the genes that are meant to be expressed in higher organisms. And RNA is very similar to DNA. The difference is it's very minor chemically, yet profoundly important in their stability. So RNA is inherently unstable. So you have a master blueprint that gets copied to this unstable messenger that ultimately gives information to the cell as to how to make a protein that uses structure or metabolism, whatever. It's kind of like your USB drive. That's like RNA. Your computer is like DNA. It's a hard drive. It's information locked away in one place. Your USB drive is the temporary thing that you wash and dry in the dryer. Sometimes it works after that, but it's temporary. And so RNA is like that. And so there's a number of RNA viruses, probably owing to their evolution, that they're a little bit, they're quite ancient, that RNA is their genetic material. So Ebola, HIV, rabies, hepatitis, there's a whole series of RNA viruses, Marburg virus. They're really good at mutating rapidly, because it's only one single strand. So errors have no other template to serve as their ability to be corrected. So that's what an RNA virus is. And as you mentioned, coronavirus and influenza are both RNA viruses.
That's another interesting difference that we can discuss, is the coronavirus they don't know how quickly it mutates or how it mutates exactly. And so that's one thing that's going to make it difficult to prevent and treat, I believe, is that you don't know how much it's changing. So can you tell us a little more about that?
Well, it's very easy for these viruses to change, and as long as they're changing in ways that do not affect their transmission. So the ability to jump from organism to organism, so both of influenza and coronavirus are zoonotic. So that means that they can be passed from animals to people or from person to person. And what that means is that you don't only have to cause infection, you have to be able to be transmissible in order to be a good virus. One that works is a pathogen that fails by killing the first infection doesn't become a problem. And so the idea is that you have to be that their mutation changes the ability of the virus to evade our vaccines, our surveillance, our testing, but also could affect its transmissibility. We just don't know. But both viruses are subject to genetic changes, and that's all that is.
Very good. Now, we also know, or I should say we don't know, what the individual immune response is to this virus yet for different people. So can you talk a little bit about why that might be a problem as we're trying to get this thing under control?
Well, it's in terms of the coronavirus, we don't understand necessarily what are the other molecular characteristics of patients that cause the variability in infection from elderly folks down to younger folks. There are some differences that we do see in cells in immune response. As you age, you have different, your thymus gland isn't as active. There's a lot of other changes that happen in terms of immunology as we age. But, that right now is still a really open question with coronavirus.
And then the final big difference that I wanted to cover is COVID-19, or I should say the virus itself, rather, not the disease, is a positive sense virus versus influenza being negative sense. So what does that mean in layman's terms?
Well, you're going back into the molecular biology geeks here. So
I can't help myself.
No, Matt, neither can I. You're talking to the right guy. So when you're looking at DNA, you think of one of the strands as having the information. The other strand is having a complement to that information. So you think about A, G, C, and T as the code, right? Well, on the other strand, there's a complementary code, A bonding with T, G with C. And we think of one strand as the plus strand, one strand as the minus strand, or one strand as the coding strand, one as the non-coding strand. Viruses have their information is either the coding strand, where what it means is that in the parlance of molecular biology, which means you can take that RNA and translate it by looking, meaning you can have the information to make a protein directly from it, versus the other side, which means you need to create an RNA from the RNA that then serves as the template for proteins. It just is an extra step. And so that's the real big deal between the two. I think what it really means is just that one does things a little bit differently in terms of how it copies its genetic material.
Okay, so just to wrap it up then, there's still a lot we don't know. It's an evolving situation. And so I don't know, maybe irresponsible is the wrong word, but it's certainly premature to say, oh, it's just the flu. You know, I believe that may be one of the outcomes, is that it just becomes one of these seasonal infections that we have to deal with to a certain extent, but we just don't know yet, I think, is the takeaway.
Well, the takeaway. So, before we do a takeaway, let me just give you a couple other thoughts here, is that some of the other similarities mentioned in the article was that both of them have natural reservoir. And that influenza usually originates in birds. We can look in bird populations in China and start to understand what might be coming here. And that's how they devise the vaccines against it. Coronaviruses seem to have their biggest reservoirs in bats. And this is really interesting because this virus is probably banging around in bats everywhere, only we don't have much exposure to them because we're not really hanging around bats. I mean, here and there you see one, but that doesn't do it. Unless you butcher and eat them. And in some parts of the world, bats are part of the diet sometimes. And it seems like SARS-CoV-2 and I think Ebola both came from bats. And the other potential reservoir that's been tapped is the pangolin. So you should look up pangolin and Google pangolin, P-A-N-G-O-L-I-N. Pangolin is the only scaled mammal. It looks like an armadillo that lost its shell, but it wears a suit of armor. This thing also tests positive for a very similar virus. So, you know, there are natural reservoirs of these viruses, and just how they skip to humans is part of their cycle.
Right. So now the pangolin would be sort of like a middleman between bats and humans. I forget the technical term for it, but I believe that's the role it fills. Is that right?
I think it middleman is good, but I don't know that that's true. I think the pangolin is actually considered a delicacy. And so people do eat this thing and do butcher it up. And so maybe that is a way in which humans are exposed. So that's the another way in which these two things are the same, and that they both come through an animal intermediate, a zoonotic intermediate.
Right. Okay. That's interesting. Cause I don't remember. It might've been Science Magazine where they said that maybe it originated in bats and then the intermediate was the pangolin, but I could be mixing that up.
No, you know, you're right. I just am curious if pangolins are the reservoir that passed it to humans.
Oh, and, I gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, bats and pangolins are probably hanging out quite a bit. I don't know where pangolins live, but whatever. But let's just talk about a couple other ways in which these things are similar. Just, you know, we talked about differences. How are they similar?
Sure.
And both of them have respiratory symptoms that, you know, pneumonia, body aches, fatigue. And so you see so many tests that are coming back negative, which are people reporting to emergency rooms or being tested because they have respiratory symptoms, yet are not testing positive for COVID-19 or, you know, or as it's SARS-CoV-2 is the virus. So they're not showing, they're testing positive for symptoms, but not for the virus. And it's actually quite a few cases. So a few of these are certainly turning out to be influenza A. The other big difference is that we have a way to control influenza A by vaccination, but as of right now, no way to control SARS-CoV-2.
Right. Well, speaking of vaccines, that is where our next story takes us. And this is from Patrick Tucker at a website called Defense One. And according to this story, anyway, there's a Canadian company that says it already has a vaccine for the virus, but it's got to go through FDA approval, which is going to take possibly a year and a half, maybe 2 years. So, Kevin, again, tell us a little bit about the genetics of this. This is a plant-based vaccine versus the ones that are typically developed in eggs.
Oh, I love this. and I think that this is something that should give everybody a little bit of a ray of hope, because this COVID-19 is not the first and not the last virus that will emerge that will become a pandemic. And our ability to respond rapidly to these kinds of threats is so critical. And that's why the military has invested heavily in a company called Medicago. And Medicago is up in Quebec. They have another center down in North Carolina. You know, all things on the table. I've actually visited them and given seminars there and had great interaction with that group. They're fantastic. And apparently they've made the first vaccine, potential vaccine, 20 days after the sequence was made available by the Chinese government. So what this means is that they got the information, the genetic DNA information for what SARS-CoV-2 is, and we're able to assemble a protein from that, come up with a protein from that DNA sequence in very short time. And right now they say that if they had to, they can make 10 million doses a month starting as soon as 2021.
Yeah, it's good news to be sure. But I want to know a little more about how they actually produce it. And technically, I guess you would call this a GMO or a transgenic product that they're producing. So tell us about the process of actually developing this.
Well, yes and no. And that's what's so interesting about this. So typically when you make a vaccine, you're injecting the virus into eggs. And so you use the eggs as the bioreactor. And it's extremely expensive. It takes it's done at massive scale. So, you know, it's something that's very well-traveled territory. And within that, you can make the virus. Then you either kill or isolate the protein code of the virus, which is used in vaccines. The alternative is, if you take this sequence of SARS or SARS-CoV-2, or at least one little part, and this is the coronavirus that causes the current issue, take a little part of its genetic material that encodes the protein signatures on the coat, or the little projections that they use to that identify this as a coronavirus. I think they call them S proteins, but these little projections. If you take that information and have the plant make it, now you can take that protein back out and use that in vaccines. So, of course, to do this, we use the tricks of genetic engineering. We take the sequence, which we, as we discussed a few weeks ago, you can order online. You can stick that into a bacterium called Agrobacterium, have Agrobacterium infect the cells of plants. And in the lab, what we do is we use a type of tobacco called Nicotiana benthamiana. I'm not sure exactly what Medicago is using for this. Obviously, Medicago is alfalfa. They may be using a whatever kind of plant to do this efficiently. But you take the Agrobacterium, what we do in the lab is take that Agrobacterium, stick it into a syringe. So all those pictures online are not entirely wrong. Then we take a syringe full of Agrobacterium without a needle, and you put the leaf in your palm of your hand with a rubber glove and press the Agrobacterium into the leaf. On scale, places like Medicago may dip the leaves into Agrobacterium solution and apply a vacuum, something we call vacuum infiltration. And under vacuum, you can imagine the leaf will compress down to a very thin layer, and all the air in it will be pushed out. And then when you release the vacuum, the leaf kind of puffs up and sucks in some of the agrobacterium. The Agrobacterium makes a genetic exchange inside the cells of the leaf, and you get what's called transient gene expression. It means the genes may not be permanently installed into the DNA of the host plant, but the DNA is there and there to be expressed and produces the protein that you're interested in this case, part of the signature of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So that's how it works.
And the idea is it's like any other vaccine where you inject this protein into your system, and then your immune system goes, oh, I know what this is. And then it can protect you should you be exposed to the virus. Is that right?
That's right. You're basically showing your immune system a wanted poster. And now your immune system says, okay, cool. If I see this, I'm on it. And then this way, when SARS-CoV-2 shows up, now all of a sudden your immune system is pre-primed in order to respond properly to that viral threat. That's how all of our viral vaccines work, whether it's hepatitis, whether it's whatever. And actually, that's what's interesting about this is the hepatitis vaccine that now is being used is coming through genetic engineering, is cultured probably in a similar thing in yeast or plants, and has been remarkably useful against hepatitis C, which previously could have been a long-term death sentence. So right now people are being cured because of these viruses, or because of these vaccines that are coming through viruses or through viral sequence expressed in yeast or plants.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a recombinant flu vaccine as well. So the technology is getting around in terms of making new medicines available. Now, one of the benefits of this approach they're using is that it's cheaper and faster. And as we just discussed a minute ago, the virus is expected to mutate pretty rapidly. And so this approach might help them come up with new vaccines. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, that's the important part, is that it's a lot faster than using the eggs. Here you can hammer through new sequence very quickly to produce a protein, which then you can use as a vaccine to induce the immune response against the virus. And it allows it to go very quickly. And they even estimate you can do this, you know, from beginning to end, you know, in a few weeks if not, you know, at least be able to demonstrate proof of concept. People have been injected with this stuff already, I understand. Its phase one trials are now going to be scheduled for July, August, that kind of time frame. But the beauty of this is that it allows us to use plants and as a alternative to yeast and other microbes to very rapidly manufacture the proteins that allow us to create better vaccines than those that are created through eggs. So that's the main deal, and probably very, very positive, optimistic information about the future pandemics.
Right. Now, the process itself seems to be pretty quick, pretty rapid, but it's actually the FDA review that's going to take some time. I think they said fall 2021 is when it's likely that this vaccine will be in mass production and available to everybody. And you mentioned phase one trials. And so there's actually three phases, I believe, on top of animal studies they have to do. So let's talk just about that for just a minute so people have a sense. So what are they doing in the phase one trials? Are they just trying to make sure it's safe and that it doesn't elicit some kind of dangerous immune response?
That's the big one on phase one. Is it safe at the levels that are administered? Phase two, you start going into higher levels of safety and efficacy. Phase three then is really a test of, does it do what it purports to do? And so that's really the tough one to get over. You can imagine in these kinds of trials in humans are very challenging because you can't have one placebo group that you give a fake vaccine and then cough in their face. I mean, it's just not the way, it's not the way we do this, you know? So this process for vaccines is a little bit different, but it's rigorous. It's tested. This is well-traveled territory. And frankly, if you came up to me today with a syringe full of plant protein against SARS-CoV-2, saying that it would allow me to get back to work and be immune from this thing, I'd take it today. And, you know, I'd go out and have a normal life. I think this will be something that will be part of our normal vaccine schedule after this year. So stand by.
Yeah. And by the way, I think this does a pretty good job of dispelling this idea that the pharmaceutical industry owns the FDA and we just get plugged full of medications that aren't properly tested. Because if you can look at this example, right, this infection is killing a lot of people. And the fastest we can get a medicine because of regulatory review is almost, well, over a year, year and a half, maybe. You know what I mean? So I think that puts to bed this idea that of the anti-vax crowd that, you know, you're just getting plugged with stuff willy-nilly.
Well, yeah, exactly. It shows it's not a rubber stamp. And this is a rigorous process that will go on for a long time. And ultimately, the idea is, how can we create better compounds that can help people be safe from chronic disease? And in the case of, or acute disease in the case of this. But the idea here is a simple one. As it stands, as of today, the concern is, how do we not max out the healthcare system like is what's happening in Italy? And right now it's a question of, how do you just keep the basal population safe? And in the case of influenza, we use the influenza vaccine. And I think starting after 2021, 2022, you're going to get your coronavirus vaccine against COVID, or against SARS-CoV-2. I think that's what you're going to see. COVID-2, SARS-CoV-2. That'll be a normal part of the vaccine schedule.
Right on. Well, we do have another virus story to talk about, but this one's actually really positive. So let's get off this negative kick that we've been talking about for a while. So Kevin, tell us about this, because this is apparently the second patient to be possibly cured of HIV thanks to an experimental stem cell transplant. So walk us through this, because this story is just crazy. It's almost accidental is what it sounds like.
Well, this is so good. This was originally done by Ed Cara at Gizmodo this week. And you can't wipe the smile off of my stupid face with this story. Back when Magic Johnson contracted HIV back in the 90s, you think about this. I remember this very well. You know, this was a death sentence. Freddie Mercury had just passed away. People were infected and not living very long. there were promises that were coming from antiviral therapies that ultimately would turn out to be these lifelong cocktails that people would take to suppress the replication of the HIV or the human immunodeficiency virus. I always hate when they say HIV virus because a V is virus. Anyway, so this is about the London
machine.
Yeah, I know. It drives me nuts, right? The London patient. And this guy, this unfortunate guy, had not had Hodgkin's lymphoma and HIV. I mean, he's playing from the bottom of the deck here. Poor dude. So in order to solve the Hodgkin's lymphoma, he needs a bone marrow transplant. You know, this is a blood cancer. So you ablate the bone marrow using chemicals or radiation and then give new bone marrow, which from a donor that presumably would give you the correct genetic information without the cancer. So you kill the cancer cells, you put in the new bone marrow, gives rise to new blood that does not have this malignancy. Pretty easy. Now, here's the issue with this particular story. Since this patient was HIV positive, what if you could get bone marrow from a person who genetically could not get HIV? So remember those twins that had mutations that the scientist in China gave them, these CRISPR-based mutations so that they could never get HIV? Remember that story?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, so these twins could never get HIV because the receptor that docks with the HIV virus was mutated, was gone. And there's some people that have this naturally. So last March, well, even before that, the idea was let's give the London patient bone marrow from a person with this mutation. And the London patient should never have an HIV problem. And so the idea was get rid of the stem cells that are producing bad blood, replace them with something that makes good blood that then cannot be infected by the virus. And last March, his doctor said that there were no detectable traces of virus in his system for 18 months after antiretroviral therapies. And in a normal course of things, it takes a few weeks before the virus starts coming back up. You know, the viral titers are measured in the blood. So here, this London patient was free from increases in viral titer. And, you know, of course, physicians are saying it's still too early to say that he's cured. But the study that came out this week in Lancet HIV, it says they're really confident that this guy is cured.
So this is a huge step forward, obviously, but it sounds like there's a little caution warranted. And I believe some experts came forward and they said, this is very significant, but we need to be careful because we can't really know if this is a cure yet, just yet. So I think one of the concerns they had is that the procedure is risky. So what do you know about that? Why is that a concern for more people, I should say?
Well, sure. Well, bone marrow transplant is a risky situation. You can have all kinds of rejection issues, cytokine storm, all these things that can happen. And so it's impractical to really recommend a bone marrow transplant with HIV-proof bone marrow for everybody. It also would put you on a lifetime regimen of other anti-rejection drugs. So there's all kinds of other ways, other problems that come in with this therapy. And right now, HIV can be managed with drugs. There are a number of drugs which are used to limit viral replication. It works really well. People are living long, healthy, productive lives. So to take the risk and expense of a bone marrow transplant doesn't seem to tip it just yet. But we'll watch for that change. There may come a time when you can go to a stem cell clinic in your neighborhood and get an HIV reduction bone marrow transplant. Who knows? I mean, things are moving so fast and so furious, but it just makes me, I mean, how do you feel about this? I mean, do you remember HIV being like a one-way death sentence? And the fact that we now have people who are essentially cured, how do you think about that?
I'm not sure how to think about it, honestly, because it's so big. And I remember being a kid and hearing about somebody getting HIV and how serious that was, you know, in many cases, it meant they were going to die. There just wasn't that much we could do. But I think it speaks to the power of biomedicine, of the things that, that we can do and how quickly it's evolved, you know? So, you know, fortunately I've never had any kind of infection like this, but I think about if you can treat something as serious as HIV with stuff like this, you know, what about a more common condition that more people are likely to get, someone like you or me, you know? So it makes me hopeful that we're going to get more cool stuff like this in the future.
Well, for me, I was in college from in high school and college from like 1981 to 1989. So I was in like those really cool years of, you know, meeting other people and potential exchange of fluids that was during that window. And so people were so freaked out about HIV, you know, and it really was a major concern that you were always very careful about people who had, I mean, and not just like sexual contact, but like blood, you know, was such a freak out. And it really changed the way that we dealt with blood, whether it's in, you know, blood draw situations or sports injuries or whatever, because HIV was at the time, this is a death sentence. And you would never really have casual connections with people because of the fact that it could kill you. And this was a major issue back then. And I remember how nervous we all were as a population because of this being a one-way trip. But so many people were infected in ways that they could not avoid, whether it was Ryan White, who from a blood transfusion was infected, thousands of Haitians at the time. There's so many people who today, because of passive ways of getting it, low risk ways of getting it, this kind of therapy could be the foundation of the way that they'll be cured. And that just makes me so happy.
Well, yeah. And that reminds me of another aspect, which is in the developing world, this is a much bigger deal because they don't have the public health resources and the awareness that we do. It just comes with, you know, becoming a more affluent society. You start to think more about these. So with these kind of treatments becoming available, that stands to benefit millions of people in the poorest countries around the world. So that's exciting as well.
And that's a beautiful point. And thank you for bringing that up. You know, areas in Africa in other parts of the developing world, that HIV is still a tremendous problem. And wow, anything that could, my guess is they're not going to be candidates for industrialized world bone marrow transplants right now. But by understanding the genetics of this, how you can stop HIV by removing the receptor, what if we can come up with drugs to block that receptor? And these are things that laboratories are working on every single day. And I hope with the developing world, you know, in the back of their minds every single day, because it would really change the lives of many people.
Right. Now, I know that's a bit more controversial when you start talking about editing human DNA to either cure or prevent disease. I mean, we just talked about the first procedure that was done for that just on our last episode. So there's probably some ethical concerns, but on just the purely scientific side, we're getting there. You know, it's going to take some time and some wrangling, but progress is being made.
No, great point. And I do think that we'll get there. I think you'll see the next generation of drugs that target the receptors and block the docking of the virus. You're going to see some very interesting things happening in the next few years. So, you know, let's cross our fingers and, you know, really, you know, let's celebrate that science has saved it right now at least two lives that normally would be suffering a lifelong regimen of drugs, antiviral drugs, but now might even go on to live normal lives, cured of cancer and HIV, two things that 50 years ago would have been a death sentence for these young people.
Yeah, well, let's follow up on this as the research progresses, because there's so many interesting questions, you know, whether they're, as I said, ethical or political or how you would use a treatment like this to help more people, if that even becomes feasible. So we'll definitely revisit this, but let's move on to this Pew survey, Kevin, about opinions of American adults on GMOs. And they use the phrase GM food or genetically modified food. I don't really like that, but in any event, so According to the survey, 51% of Americans think GMOs are worse for people's health than foods with no genetically modified ingredients. So let's start there, and then we'll move on to the other things they found. What do you think about that? What does that tell you?
Well, the sad part about this is that we have two stories back to back here, where one shows that when we trust the genetics and trust the science, that we can save lives and do beautiful things. And another side that says, in this case of this story, that the bad information that's out there that's misinforming people is still present. And so we're able to do beautiful things with genetics and with modern science. Yet here's a case where people say that modern science and modern technologies and crops are actually having a negative effect on their health. And that's pretty amazing.
The survey didn't explain, you know, what conditions people are talking about, but I would be curious what they think about, because as you and I know, nobody's gotten so much as a stomach ache from a genetically engineered crop. And so I am curious, what do they think? You know, what information have they consumed? Do they think it's, you know, cancer and that kind of stuff? Or is it just, you know, allergies? I'm really curious about that. What's your take? I mean, this is your expertise as an educator. What are the most common things people are afraid of?
Well, I think it's all the above. And I don't know that they're necessarily afraid of any particular disease as much as they're afraid of intervention of technology in their food. Because, you know, food is really important. It's the bottom line of the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's the thing that lights up our reptile brains. It's socially important. It's important with our families to sit around for holidays, to sit with our neighbors and, you know, enjoy meals. This is a really important thing for us as human beings. And so what you're really seeing is an affluent nation, which has disposable income, that's saying, I don't want technology in my food, and I can afford to have it not in my food. And anybody telling me that it's in my food, I'm going to reject that because I think it's not healthy. That's what you're seeing.
Yeah, and that's another interesting aspect of this survey. And this confirms other research that's been done, but they found that the more people said they knew about the technology, the more skeptical they were of it. And so, again, what that tells me, and again, correct me if I'm wrong here, but what that tells me is they're doing a lot of Googling, and maybe they're finding Jeffrey Smith's website, or they're finding US Right to Know, and they're taking that stuff at face value because they think they know a lot, but clearly they don't. So what's your insight on that?
No, you're exactly right. And this is work that follows up on a study last year by Fernbach et al. Out of Colorado State University. And he's, a social psychologist who was looking at how much people thought they knew versus what they actually knew. And it's the old Dunning-Kruger effect, right? People who believe that they knew the most about the topic of genetic engineering and its relationship to health actually were the most ill-informed. And I think you and I realize that we can blame this squarely on the internet and its pinata of misinformation that has steered people away from a technology that could help solve some agricultural problems. And certainly there are the advocates out there who will scream from the mountaintops that this is dangerous technology. And their words have meaning, and they do change the behaviors and perceptions in an affluent society. So really that's what you're seeing here. And in this Pew survey, it basically says that, people don't know much about it, but they're afraid of it. And they think the difference is, and right there, that's not uncommon, right? We fear the unknown. The difference is these people think that they are the experts. So it's not a question of there's an unknown where we can fix the problem. There's an unknown where there are people who are falsely claiming to know the answers. And that's why this is such a problem.
The other really curious part to me is that the people who responded to the survey, they were able to pick up on some subtler points that I didn't think they would understand given what they said about GMOs being harmful. But 62% of people said that genetic engineering was more likely to cut the price of food. And then they also said that it was going to help address hunger around the world. And so those are two, they're not that difficult to grasp, but it takes a little understanding to realize that, well, they engineer these crops so they can, you know, they can be treated with weed killer, or they're resistant to attacks from insects, and that as a result boosts yields. And so they seem to have some understanding of this issue, but they still think it's dangerous in some way. I just don't understand how they could get one but not get the other correct.
Well, but I think what you're seeing there is that, you know, the people who understand that it is fairly likely to help food security or lower the cost of food, people get that. And quite a few people, when you look across an entire population, they understand that technology can help in those regards. Even people who are unfamiliar or uneducated in the discipline still can understand that. Certainly, that's what genetics has taught us over the last 100 years. But there's the few people who make a tremendous amount of noise who talk about the risks and the fears. And I think they're losing their voice, and they're becoming much quieter over time, yet it still has an effect that we see. And we can get out there and talk about the science. It doesn't matter. We talked about this last week. It's all about the values we have and how do we use good technology to make lives better for people in the planet. And that's where our messaging needs to be.
How do you, and again, this is right up your alley, but how do you do that if people don't trust you? And you're a good example of this, but I don't mean just you personally, because people malign you on the internet, and then out of the gate, you have this negative reputation that you have to combat. So how do you build trust with people so you can get good information to them when they think that you work for the devil?
Sure. And it's actually kind of funny because, you know, there's a little sliver of people who even today and yesterday, you know, all over the internet, oh, he's just working for Monsanto. Company that doesn't even exist anymore. But what's so funny is if you look at what I actually do and what I actually study and who the beneficiaries are, it doesn't match anything what they say. And, you know, there's been newspaper articles that say I'm on the inner circle of corporate lobbyists and PR people, strategists. And say, oh my God, you know, I'm a scientist who farms in his off time. You know, I'm a not very exciting guy. So what I can do to talk to somebody to earn their trust is talk about the things we have in common. And at the end of the day, I want safe food. I want healthy food. I want this for the poorest people. I want it to reach the poorest nations. And I want to help our environment survive in the, you know, even very fragile systems. And I want our farmers to stay in business because there's not a whole lot of them. And I married the one of them, and I see what she goes through every single day. So I would love her to have more tools and more availability. So for me, when I talk about my biggest interest being farmers, the consumers that can eat better food, the environment, and the food insecure, you find that you're on the same page as just about anybody, including people who are really staunchly against genetic engineering. And then we can start to have conversations about what are the pluses and minuses and how do we use the technology? So that's my strategy, and actually works really well.
Yeah. Well, I only see the interactions that show up in my Twitter feed where these people are yelling at you and you go, well, you know, that's fine. You can think that, but I'm not a bad guy, I promise. But is it effective online as well as in person, or does the medium of communication influence how the conversation turns out?
Well, you never influence the haters, right? The people who are just decided you're the worst person in the world will never stop doing it. But what you do influence are the people who are watching. And there are a number of books and studies that tell us that for every person who is commenting, there are thousands that are watching the conversation. And so this is a place where you can get in and make sure that your values are clear, that your motivations are transparent, that what you do is right. And with that, and with that kind of honesty, you do win the favor of changing those conversations. And, you know, over time, it really has changed. You know, there's still a few diehards out there who still malign me as, you know, Satan's spawn, devil incarnate, because I tell the truth about biotechnology. But, you know, I think that number is getting smaller. And it's kind of fun to go through the old tweets and articles and stuff and see where we were. I think that communicating science, especially through mediums like this, we are making a difference. So very grateful to have this time with you and with the audience.
Very well said. And I think that's a good place to leave it for the week. So as always, this is Cameron English with the Genetic Literacy Project. And of course, Dr. Kevin Folta. And we'll be back next week with another set of brand new stories to talk about. Kevin, give people your website and your Twitter handle and all that before we jump off.
Sure. You can look at me at kevinfolta.com. Twitter handle is at Kevin Folta. And I need to say that what we've discussed today are the opinions of Cameron English and Kevin Folta, and do not by any means represent those of the faculty, staff, and students of the University of Florida. So there you go. They're very much sticklers of how we provide information to the public. And while I think that informing the public is part of my job, they feel very differently, that this kind of conversation is something that is not part of the university outreach. So just that's me covering my butt. So there you go.
Okay, butt covered. It's the opinion of a PhD geneticist who studies this for a living.
Yeah. Well, you know, by covering your butt is important these days with it's not just your coughs, right? Anyway, I'll stop there.
All right, everybody. Well, check us out at geneticliteracyproject.org. You can get the podcast for free as well as all the articles we've been talking about. We just give it to you. That's how we roll. And then we're on Twitter, Facebook. I'm at Cam J English, and we're at Genetic Literacy on Twitter. So with that, we will see you next week. Thank you so much.